This is an ABC podcast.
G'day, beloved listeners. Well, of course, today all the political gossip is about secret lovers. But when it comes to secret lovers, premiers aren't in the same league as prime ministers. The few chaste PMs I'm aware of include Rudd and Keating and, to the best of my knowledge, Turnbull and Scott Morrison, whereas many of the others, well, had secret lovers. For a full and surprising list, send me cash in a self-addressed envelope. And by amazing coincidence, today is an historic day when it comes to political misbehaviour, because on this very day, Malcolm Fraser memorably lost his trousers in Memphis, and I believe a reward is still available for their return. Coming up, Ian Duntfurst, and I've had to tweet a warning. I've been reading his tweets and he's in a very bad mood. Then, a little later, we're going to be talking to an old friend of the program, and Jeff Kidney. You know, before Laura, Jeff was our voice on Canberra politics, and it's been a long time between drinks. He's coming back to discuss his new book, Beyond the Newsroom. And in the middle, we're going to look at the impact on Bolivian politics of, oil and gas. But first, be upstanding for Ian Dunt. Now, Ian, first of all, you should be in a good mood, because I understand your book's selling like clappers.
Yes, indeed. That is actually quite nice. And now that you say that, I suppose I probably should improve my mood. But nevertheless, I'm still forced to engage on a daily basis with the extraordinary systematic idiocy of the British government. And that rather puts a dampener on things, I find.
Now, let's talk about something that you find some pleasure in. And that is finally a pretty good response on COVID from Keir Starmer.
Yeah, interesting development here. So since he took the leadership, Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, has been sort of basically saying, look, we'll support what the government does on coronavirus, but you're not doing it very well. So it's essentially to say, look, you're very incompetent, Boris Johnson, but ultimately we'll support all of these measures as they come in. Yesterday, that changed. And it changed because Boris Johnson opened up a space. Until now, Boris Johnson has been able to wrap himself with this defensive shield that says, look, I'm just doing what the scientists tell me. The scientists in this case come from a committee called SAGE, which are these guys that provide the scientific guidance to the government. Now Boris Johnson has moved away from that. They put out a recommendation to him saying, look, we need a circuit breaker lockdown. That's a 2 to 3 week lockdown. Get this thing under control. Stop the rising levels. Sort out your test and trace. Put this under some kind of control. He wouldn't do it. The reason he won't do it is because his own party is increasingly turning into this lockdown skeptic party that's sort of starting to promote these arguments of just let coronavirus flush through the population, protect sort of the more elderly, the more vulnerable, and off we go. That departure meant that Keir Starmer had a space. Keir Starmer comes out yesterday, it's his first monthly televised press conference, and says, look, we're demanding that circuit breaker now. So finally, what you're getting from Starmer is an actual alternative position rather than just criticism of the method by which the government is pursuing a policy that he fundamentally agrees with.
So what is the scientific advice that Starmer is listening to and consequently advocating as a result of?
At the heart of it is this idea of the circuit breaker. And actually, some of the information we're seeing today come out is quite shocking stuff. And they're saying even at the lowest levels, you'd be saving thousands of lives by introducing this 2 to 3 week lockdown. At the highest level, they're talking about 170,000 lives could be saved by this thing. The reason for that is because, once again, coronavirus in Britain has gotten out of control. The test and trace system, which we were promised, they say world leading for every single thing ministers announce. Everything's going to be a world beating or a world leading system. and it never transfer, it never really exists. And when it does come out, it's usually a very pitiful version of what exists in other countries. That system is still not in place. Furthermore, the restrictions that are being imposed are regional, and they're actually quite modest. Some of them make absolutely no sense at all. I mean, one of them is a 10 p.m. curfew in pubs. Now, there is no empirical basis for that 10 p.m. curfew to exist. It's not as if coronavirus decides it doesn't want to infect people after 10 p.m. The reason they came to that is because in between the hawks and the doves around his cabinet table, the only thing that Boris Johnson could find agreement on was a 10 p.m. curfew. So you get these increasingly sort of tragicomic initiatives that aren't based on any kind of empirical research, and they're not effective. So coronavirus again spiraling out of control. The main message from these guys is, look, we need the kind of lockdown we had before, not for as long, not including schools, but we need it just to try and get the rest of the system up and running. If we don't, there's a chance that the NHS will be run out of control.
You make the point that Starmer's position brings him in line with public opinion. That's quite unusual for the Labour Party.
Yes, indeed. I think it's the first time that's been happening to the Labour Party for about 7 years now. And that's actually quite a notable development, because the government, Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's right-hand man, and the Prime Minister himself are obsessed with public opinion. They use focus groups all the time, internal polling all the time, I mean, several a day, in order to work out exactly where it is and to stay on the right side of it. Public opinion on coronavirus is actually pretty draconian. It's, I mean, 40% say that the government's current position doesn't go far enough. People are scared of coronavirus for very good reason. They saw what happened in the spring. They're aware that the government doesn't really have a handle on it. And this is one of those rare instances where the government hasn't just left the scientific advice, it's also left public opinion. It's not operating according to where the median voter actually is. Starmer shifting onto the scientific advice doesn't just protect him in terms of the reasoning behind what he's saying, but it also puts him much more in line with where the average voter is. So overall, not bad for one day's work from Starmer.
What about within Boris's ranks? Does he have substantial backing from his Tory MPs?
No, not at all. And in fact, it's actually quite notable just how aggressive they're being over this. There was a vote on the 10 p.m. curfew yesterday, which Labour abstained on. And there he had over 80 MPs rebelling against him. The Tory parliamentary party is really starting to become totally seduced by the sort of herd immunity argument. Herd immunity is not a very good word for something, because actually we get herd immunity through vaccines, but that's not what these guys are talking about. What they're talking about is a position of saying, just let it flush through. You know, we'll protect the vulnerable, protect the elderly, but just let it flush through the population. The young will get it, we'll develop herd immunity, and we'll all be fine. Now, there is almost no scientific support for this whatsoever. There's a couple of relatively senior scientific figures from other fields who've expressed support, but they haven't produced any models that would show that it would work. The consensus, the overwhelming consensus in the scientific community is we cannot do this. We do not have the manner in which to shield vulnerable communities, the elderly, the sick, from this disease. This is not an avenue that we can take. And even if we could, the growing evidence on long COVID means that it's not even ethical to be able to say to the young, just go out there and get it. And yet, nevertheless, this view is really starting to take over the Tory parliamentary party. You're hearing it from MP after MP after MP. And Boris Johnson is really struggling to contain it as it is.
Ian, can we move from number 10 to 100 Pennsylvania Avenue and back again? I understand Boris and co. are now confronting the fact that Biden may well be the next US president.
Yeah, they are. So suddenly we're getting moves in number 10, jittery moves of thinking, well, actually, hang on a minute. It looks like this guy might actually win this thing. Thinking they need to, you know, raise an olive branch. Now, that's obviously made very, very difficult, because Boris Johnson has responded in a quite appalling way to the Democrat Party. You may remember he made a just dispiriting comment about Obama's part Kenyan heritage as an explanation for why he was apparently so hateful of the British. He wasn't remotely hateful of the British, and the phrase had a very obvious racial slur contained within it. That has not been forgotten by Democrats. They also haven't forgotten the speed and sort of lack of dignity with which the British sort of got down on their knees in front of Trump when he got here. I mean, you may remember Theresa May decided to give him a state visit, which is far beyond anything she needed to do. all, of course, in this desperate attempt to try and get a US trade deal. The trade deal itself was irrelevant, by the way, for a couple of reasons. The first one is the British public will never accept US agricultural standards on imports, and the US will never sign a trade deal without those standards being contained within it. The second one was that the Democrats were in control of Congress, and Congress do get to sign off on US trade deals. So even on a strategic level, it made no sense, but politically it was pursued anyway. Now, in the face of what looks, fingers crossed, touch wood, like an incoming Biden victory, number 10 is completely at odds and doesn't really have a very clear opening as to how it's going to re-establish close relationships with Biden.
Well, if number 10 has to change its view of what's going on in the US, it's also changing the way it briefs the press. Tell me about that.
Yeah, interesting development here. So, I mean, I am a lobby journalist. Lobby journalist means that you work in the House of in the Houses of Parliament. You are given what's called privileged access to the Prime Minister's spokesman in the morning and the afternoon. Now, these briefings are held off camera. They're on the record. They used to be in the Palace of Westminster and were then moved to Downing Street itself, a quite important movement there because it takes it from Parliament to the government. Now, it's suddenly going to be on TV. So essentially, it's going to look like what you see in the US. Now, this is culturally a massive change, but also constitutionally, it suggests that what's happening is Boris Johnson is trying to move towards that presidential system rather than the parliamentary sovereignty system that we've had so far. It's going to make for good TV, but the clear push is once more towards a presidential system that gives him that bit more power, that bit more media focus and attention.
The voice of our regular commentator on UK politics, Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk, and Enel on Radio National. Coming up, how oil and gas have affected and afflicted Bolivia. Hardly a day passes in our politics when we don't see the crushing power of the fossil fuel lobby on our political processes, and we're not on our own entirely. Bolivia is a country that's been exploited for its natural resources over a long period, and the chaotic politics that have ensued can be traced from centuries ago right up to the national elections, which will be held this Sunday. Now, our next guest has worked extensively in Bolivia, and he makes the argument that fossil fuel reliance in its very nature lays the foundation for very deep societal problems. Brett Gustafson is an associate professor of sociocultural anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis and author of a new book, Bolivia in the Age of Gas. And Brett joins us now. Welcome to our little program in Australia.
Thank you, sir.
Brett, tell me about the beginnings of oil exploration in Latin America and what it meant for Bolivia.
Well, oil exploration really took off in the early 20th century when Standard Oil, the big giant oil company of the United States, started moving into international oil fields, among them Latin America, Mexico, Venezuela, and Bolivia to a lesser extent. And since that time, the 1920s or so, Bolivia has been sort of a lesser participant in the South American oil business, but important nonetheless because of the U.S.'s attempt to maintain geopolitical control, shall we say, over the continent.
And as you pointed out, the oil years represented imperialism, dispossession of land, and the transfer of wealth to private companies.
That happens pretty much everywhere you see oil industry. It's the nature of the business. It creates huge profits. It doesn't create a lot of jobs. It's very easy to repatriate the money back to Wall Street. And you don't really need to get too involved in the rest of the economy of the country. It's basically detached.
We know in this country that if it comes be- to a choice between the rights of miners and the rights of indigenous people. It is the former that tends to win, and as you point out, indigenous rights were not of much concern.
This is true. Certainly has been in the past, but one of the things that's sort of complicating the current moment is that the previous president was himself indigenous, yet the country's dependence on gas made even him, despite his indigenous heritage, made him even reticent to apply indigenous rights. So when it came to the needs of the national treasury, that certainly trumped indigenous rights.
We'll come back to him a little later. You've spent a lot of time with indigenous groups in Bolivia. How have their attitudes to resources like oil and gas evolved?
Well, for many years, they had very little say whatsoever. In the recent decades, indigenous peoples have mobilized politically, and while some people have a sort of outdated view of indigenous peoples as somehow not wanting development, not wanting economic growth, that's not the case. What indigenous movements want is a right to have a say in how things go. So certainly there are negative effects of oil development, mining development. Oftentimes indigenous peoples are outright opposed to that, and they should have a right to say no. But many times, because of poverty and other needs, they certainly support development, but would like to have some say in how that's monitored ecologically and how those resources are spent.
You make the point very powerfully that the oil companies made huge profits, but the state made very little. And during the boom years, Bolivians actually became heavily indebted.
Certainly, the boom years of the 70s, that was the case. And once again, it was because the oil industry was entirely run by a private company, happened to be Gulf Oil from the United States. And the government didn't have much interest in redistributing the wealth, and nor did the oil company itself. So, as happens in many oil economies worldwide, you see a paradox. It's called the resource curse. Lots of oil and not very much economic growth, and oftentimes fiscal crises.
You make the point that a complex of white supremacy was at play, with the American view that it was their right to develop the resources, and I quote, of backward places and races.
Oh, yes, certainly. That's been the case for most of the past century. That was the justification for relieving countries of their resources, was quite explicitly stated by to the presidents of the United States that those peoples weren't quite up to snuff, and they needed us to come in and help them develop.
Now, historically, Bolivia has been one of the most unstable of countries, hasn't it? Countless revolutions, coups over the last few centuries, and I guess fossil fuels accelerated this process.
Certainly, it wasn't just fossil fuels. The big product in Bolivia for many years was first silver. Then for much of the mid-century, the war years, World War I and World War II, it was tin. Bolivia was basically a provider of tin to the U.S. war machine. Tin cans for soldiers on the front in Europe, a lot of that came from Bolivia, and certainly contributed to instability. Oil took off in the 70s, and then gas has added to the complexity starting in the late 1990s. But yes.
You were living in Bolivia in the 90s, weren't you? And there was a lot of left-wing nationalist movements calling for the state ownership of gas resources.
Oh, yes. That was, in the face of these centuries of exploitation by foreign countries and foreign companies, the left has always seen government control of the resources as a pathway to a better economy, to distribution of wealth. And so certainly for many decades, the left has tried to mobilize a nationalist sensibility to say that the gas is ours or the oil is ours, and that the government should take control and redistribute that wealth.
So we move into the early 2000s and mass movements against the neoliberal agenda to privatise everything and to transfer wealth to foreign companies starts to energise the left in Bolivia. Enter Morales. Tell us a bit more about this extraordinary fellow.
Well, he's got his start leading a farmers' union. These farmers grew coca, the plant that is used to make cocaine, although in Bolivia, coca is consumed traditionally. I've chewed plenty of coca. It's not a drug. But he was targeted by the United States because of the drug war. We thought we could get rid of cocaine by getting rid of coca plants, and that didn't work out too well, but it made Evo Morales very famous and very popular because he stood up to the United States, and he ended up being elected president not just once, but three times.
He was immensely popular at his peak, wasn't he?
More than any other president in the history of Latin America. He won his first election with something like 60% of the vote, unprecedented.
And, of course, he was seen as a beacon right throughout Central and South America.
Oh, definitely, yes. It was an example to social movements across the world, quite frankly, that you could stand up to the United States.
So when does he win first?
2005 was the first election that he won. He took office 2006, and he was in there until late last year.
So what did he achieve in this, at least initially, particularly for the indigenous Bolivians?
Well, it was, symbolically speaking, it was it's a change that no one could do away with. It was sort of akin to the end of apartheid in South Africa. You had 500 years of a rule by a small minority, light-skinned elite, and finally somebody who looked like most of the country came into office. That was probably the most symbolically important thing. In terms of economic and political stability, he did better than any other president in the history of the country. 14 years of economic growth, oftentimes besting countries like Chile and Argentina and Brazil. Certainly it was because of the gas exports, but it was also because the government had pretty decent policies. They banked a lot of money. They invested in schools, roads, hospitals, health clinics. And you didn't see a bunch of profligate corruption. Now, was there corruption? Sure, it's Bolivia. But so is, you could say the same about Australia or the United States as well.
You certainly could. And you argue that a state built on fossil fuel money creates a fractured and problematic society.
Well, it's certainly a hardship to manage because you're generating a lot of extra wealth, and that certainly generates a lot of motivations for a lot of people to try to occupy positions of power just to access that wealth. Political scientists call that rent seeking. So it's not an easy ship to manage, but all in all, Evo Morales and his government did a pretty good job.
So when did things go wrong?
Well, about 2010 or 2011, the ideologically committed left-leaning portion of the government started getting sidelined, and it sort of became an effort to stay in power more than to deeply transform the country. And there were some conflicts between Evo's government and indigenous communities. There were some arrangements made with the powerful landholders of the East. And the sort of vision of a deeply transformative project kind of stagnated, and it appeared that he just wanted to stay in office.
Now, remind us of the chaotic scenes of his ousting last year.
Oh, well, the elections happened. The right wing pretty much pre-announced that they weren't going to accept the outcome if Evo won. In the night before the election, there was some confusion. The electricity was cut. A preliminary count was suspended, and then the official count was started. So lots of things that didn't look quite right, and that gave fuel to the opposition to take to the streets. And there were street blockades for 21 days. Finally, the police said they weren't going to support the government anymore. So Evo lost the support of the police. And then the OAS, the Organization of American States, had come in to do an audit, and they said there were irregularities. Evo said, okay, we'll have a do-over. But by that time, it was too late, and the military commander went on television and said that he should step down. And we call that a coup. There is some debate about that. So Evo flew off to Mexico first, and now he's in Argentina.
Now, the interim president has gone about, he's re-embraced the neocon agenda, hasn't he, privatizing just about everything?
Well, it's she, actually, and they would like to, but they really don't have a mandate for that. But it's certainly possible that if the party of Evo Morales, which is called the MAS, the Movement to Socialism, if they do not return to power, we might see a reversal of many of these nationalist policies.
So let's look at the election schedule for this weekend, delayed again and again. What's at stake?
Well, gas itself is sort of on a downward trend now. The boom years are sort of winding down, and the big issues that are at stake are, on the one hand, lithium deposits in the high Andes that many people see as a key to the batteries that will fuel the electric cars of the future. And in eastern Bolivia, there are huge plantations of soy and cattle farming that basically put the Amazonian basin at stake. I don't if you've been following the fires burning in the Amazon, that's been getting worse for a while. And so on the one hand, another potential resource boom coming, but also an ecological crisis that's at stake, as well as economic uncertainty given the decline of gas worldwide.
I think on that rather melancholy note, we will take our leave of you, Brett. Thank you very much. Brett Gustafson, Associate Professor of Sociocultural Anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis. Brett's the author of Bolivia in the Age of Gas, published by Duke University Press. And coming up on the Little Wireless program, we welcome Jeff Kitney back to the program after a long absence to take us beyond the newsroom. Feeling quite sentimental about this segment. It's lovely to be talking to Jeff. Imagine starting your career in journalism as the sole journalist on a local paper back in 1969. It would either make you or break you. Jeff Kitney, who used to be our Canberra correspondent, found himself as a trainee at the Manjimup Warren Times, which is 250 kilometres south of Perth. He did well, and he ends up in Canberra, and so began a long and successful 50-year career in journalism. He worked as a senior correspondent for many mastheads in the Gulf, starting in 75, and was also a foreign correspondent based in Berlin and London before returning to Canberra to work right up until the most recent federal election. Jeff's book, Beyond the Newsroom, Politics, Power and People, is a memoir of the period. It's a selection of articles carefully put into context for readers today. And Jeff, welcome back.
Hi, Philip. Nice to be back. Been a long time.
Tell me, once you moved to Canberra, I didn't know this story, you became the very first reporter to break the news about the dismissal.
Well, I was certainly the first to get the press release from Government House, because I was on the staircase when the Government House messenger arrived at Parliament House. I had sort of known him vaguely over the years, because he used to come and deliver press releases and put a notice on the board about what the vice regal news of the day was. Anyway, he said he had a bundle of press releases, and he handed me and said, you might like to read this. And that was the beginning of all hell breaking loose. In those days, I worked for the Perth Daily News, which was the afternoon newspaper in Perth. And we were the first paper that really had an edition that could have got the story into it. And I simply sprinted across the top of the old Parliament House, which was across a sort of gangplank that we used to have to negotiate through the ice in the winter, and picked up the old black and white telephone. I think it was a round dial in those days. And then spent the next 2 hours dictating the story. And it was the biggest selling newspaper edition of the Perth Daily News in its history. Unfortunately, it died a sad death in the 90s.
Now, as media ownership today becomes ever more concentrated, sources of anything that looks independent or balanced are shrinking. Do you think, for example, had today's media climate existed during the 80s, our leap forward in economic reform could have occurred?
I very much doubt it. I think that period of great change was when newspapers were the dominant news force, where conversations could be held in great depth, there was a lot of support for the need for reform, particularly after the Fraser years, which were seen as sort of lost and wasted years. And then along came Keating and Hawke, who were, certainly great salesmen for the idea of reform. And they had great support from the newspapers. Today, the newspapers don't have that power anymore. The media is now, there's much more of it, but it's much thinner in my experience, from what I can see.
I remember Laurie Oakes describing you blokes as the gatekeepers of the political news of the day.
Yeah, we were. They were pretty powerful positions we had because people did go to newspapers. I mean, everybody wanted to, wait to see what was in the morning newspapers. I know as a senior correspondent, waiting for the morning papers was always a nerve-wracking time because you were never sure whether you'd, been scooped by somebody else during the day. That just doesn't happen now.
Let's look at media ownership at that moment in time. We had, of course, Fairfax. We had a semi-independent David Syme, and we had the energised build-up of Murdoch.
Yes, that's right. It was more diverse. The number of correspondents was much greater. It's shrunk now. The senior reporters in Canberra are a much smaller number. The media all essentially reported politics from the centre ground. Certainly the Murdoch media is reporting it from the right. I think Fairfax media has lost a great deal of its punch. The ABC, I think, is losing its punch. You've got The Guardian. You do have other outlets. You certainly have new outlets like The Conversation and, those sorts of sites which carry debate but have very small circulation.
But even then, politicians were trying to find their way around the press, and they started to use, quite skillfully, of course, radio. I remember Keating always talking about John Laws being absolutely indispensable to him, almost as much as his close contact with the press gallery.
Oh, I think it was. And certainly Keating and Hawke used that very well. The person who really refined it and used it to sort of talk over the gallery was John Howard. He was, when he returned to the leadership of the Liberal Party, he really cultivated the shock jocks, as they became known, and used it, I think, very effectively to go to have another means of talking to people without the filters of the press gallery heavy hitters.
Next week, I hope to be doing a story on the same thing in the US. People go on and on about Fox News, but in truth, the ultra-right were first fomented by the shock jocks like Rush Limbaugh, and we tend to underrate the corrosive influence on political debate of the right-wing shock jocks.
Yes, and we had that a long time ago, and You know, it really did shape politics. It did change politics, I think, in a way that, has shifted the centre of gravity of politics to the right in Australia. There's no doubt about how much it's moved since the Keating Hawke days. It's at the moment it's quite hard to see how the Labor Party is going to get back into power, and it certainly has a huge handicap of certainly the Murdoch media, Fox News or Sky News as it is here. There's just a relentless tide of anti-Labor reporting, or certainly critical of Labor reporting, and lack of scrutiny of government.
Was the press gallery monolithic?
No, it wasn't. That was an outside view, and I remember Paddy McGuinness, when he was editor of the Financial Review, had this view that you should never allow a reporter to stay in Canberra for more than three years, because they'd become part of the pack and get infected by the Canberra disease inside the bubble, as it's called these days. But the Canberra Press Gallery was an incredibly competitive place. I mean, it was every news organisation in Australia had correspondents there. There were, very influential correspondents. The competition for news, as I said, waking up every, in the morning, when you were running a bureau and you were the senior correspondent, picking up the papers the next morning and, in trepidation that you'd missed something or something, you'd got a huge scoop that you didn't know about. That was an incredibly competitive environment. I think it's still competitive, but I think in a shallower way. I think one thing that I think has changed very fundamentally is access to other sources of information, and I'm particularly talking about the public service, the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy was a big source of tips and news and so on in those days, of alternative views. Really, nobody goes near the bureaucracy these days, and nobody can. Nobody in the bureaucracy is prepared to talk, or has the guts to talk to the media, unless it's somebody like some of those our very courageous leakers who've now ended up in court.
I'd forgotten, Jeff, that you went to China with Hawke in 78, which of course was 8 years after Gough's visit. And
it was with Doug Anthony. Philip, it was with Doug Anthony. I went with Hawke subsequently.
Ah, right. Well, I want to talk about Hawke, who you held him in pretty high regard, didn't you?
Well, I grew to regard him highly. I didn't before he became a Labor leader. And when I watched him and I followed him, through those years, the tumultuous years where he battled with all sorts of devils and demons, and the biggest demon of them all was the booze, followed by the women. And I had a great regard for Bill Hayden, and I think Bill Hayden still doesn't get enough credit for the reshaping of the Labor Party and preparing it for government. And that first cabinet that Hawke inherited from Hayden was probably the best pound-for-pound cabinet that there's been in the modern time, and maybe throughout since Federation in Australia. But Hawke had a great ability to set aside his the sort of internal party stuff to get things done. And
good cabinet meeting, didn't he?
Exactly, yeah.
Every minister that I know, even those who were very critical of Bob and think the mythology is a bit overstated, and senior public servants have always said that he ran a wonderful cabinet. Everyone got to talk.
And it didn't matter what faction they came from. They all got to express their points of view. And that, that was great leadership, I think. I think one of the things about Hawke, he wasn't really deeply ideological. I mean, he really was somebody who wanted to get things done. I mean, he showed that when he was a trade union leader. I mean, a lot of conservatives are very critical of, and some people on the Labor side are very critical of the way he led the union movement. But, he certainly reached out to business. Look at his relationship with Peter Abels and others. He was a very effective prime minister. And, I think Keating deserves huge credit for being the one who was really prepared to push the limits of reform. But I think Keating couldn't have done that without Hawke's leadership.
We're talking to Jeff Kitney about his 50 years in the business. The book is Beyond the Newsroom. So many topics I'd like to spend time on. But briefly, South Africa in 1983.
Yes, that was very intriguing. I inherited from the famous Australian cricketer Jack Fingleton, who was actually a press gallery journalist. I got to know Jackie because he was in the room next to me in the old Parliament House in the old press gallery. And Jack, when he retired, he was a correspondent for South African Argus News Group, and he asked me if I would take it over. And I said, yeah, I mean, they were paying in Kruger Rand, so it seemed like a reasonable thing to do. And it was the liberal media, you know, liberal news organisation. And out of the blue, the then South African ambassador to Australia, Dr. Dennis Worrell, who was sort of seen as, I suppose, a bit more liberal than most, called me and said, I think you should go to South Africa. I'll arrange it for you. So I went. I wrote a series of articles for the National Times about that experience.
Of loving memory.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, I was never invited to go anywhere near the South African embassy ever again. But what was, I mean, there was much about that experience that was extraordinary and horrifying, actually, really absolutely horrifying. Apartheid then was, you know, on the way to a civil war. But I had the good fortune to be introduced to somebody who I was told was a future leader of the black consciousness movement in South Africa, and he was the head of the Mine Workers Union, who was a young man called Cyril Ramaphosa, who is now the president of South Africa. So, you know, that was I was very pleased, you know, that the South African government invited me to go there, even though they clearly weren't happy about it, but it was an incredible experience.
One of the most moving parts of the book is a moment when Keating had no words. Take us to Kokoda in 1992.
Yeah, look, that was an extraordinary moment. It was had a special meaning for me because my father had fought in the islands and against the Japanese, and my father never talked about the war. He only ever talked about the beauty. He was on Bougainville, and he only ever talked about the beauty of the forests and the volcanoes and so on. When we landed at Kokoda, we touched down on a grass airstrip, having flown up through the Owen Stanley Ranges at treetop level. When we stepped out of the aircraft, these clouds of golden butterflies just took off. There were golden clouds flying around, and then everything was brilliantly green, and we went down to the village of Kokoda. And when we got there, they took us up to this mound, which had been a machine gun post, which the Australians had held against the Japanese. Inside that post were several machine guns with the barrels completely melted into molten metal because they'd been used to the point where they melted down. It was, you know, a really stunning thing. I was standing not far from Keating, and all of a sudden he hit the ground, and everybody was startled and stunned and thought something had happened. But he, of course, hit the ground and kissed the ground. There was outrage in Australia about it, I remember later. The RSL thought this was desecration and God knows what. But it was, you know, completely, I think, completely spontaneous gesture. And, you know, what else could you do? How else could you sort of mark being there at that place and in that incredibly, you know, dramatic place of, you know, extraordinary human drama and sacrifice? So I thought, you know, this was, you know, completely appropriate, even though people said, oh, well, Keating thinks he's the Pope and so on.
You were with Keating on another occasion. I didn't know this. Paul's often told me the story of visiting HM at Balmoral to discuss the upcoming Republic. And yeah, there they were.
Unfinished business.
But here's Paul and HM and the Duke tossing sausages on the barbecue, and you're there. I didn't know that.
No, we didn't get to the barbecue. We had to wait at the gate, at the front gate. In fact, it was another surreal moment because there was a whole gaggle of Australian journalists. I think Laurie Oakes and others were there. It was a big trip because Keating had been greeted when we arrived in London by the tabloid media calling him the Lizard of Oz and so on. And when we got to Balmoral, they left us at the gate and went off down to the castle and off to the barbecue. And there was a whole gaggle of Australian tourists who were sort of wandering around, and there was a couple of guys with an Australian rules football who invited the press gallery to kick the ball through the goalposts, the gateposts of Balmoral Castle, which were the goalposts. It was all a bit bizarre. But and then, of course, it wasn't until the next day that we got briefed on the conversation, and particularly Keating telling the Queen that he was going to propose that Australia become a republic. But a couple of the staff who were at that barbecue said it was really quite surreal, quite unbelievable, and a great moment of Australian history.
The overarching narrative is of the world getting increasingly more right-wing, more dangerous. And I'm wondering how much fear and anxiety you have about the future.
I am certainly anxious. I mean, I'm very apprehensive about the future of the media in Australia, and therefore, you know, that has its consequences for the future of democracy. I've certainly, from my time in Europe and from the time I spent covering the war in Yugoslavia, ethnic divisions and hatreds ran incredibly deep to the point where, you know, many, many thousands of people were killed and, in some cases in massacres. It bothers me now seeing what's happening in Europe with the rise of far right and I think more seriously and more worryingly, the rise of nationalism in Europe. That's what Brexit is all about. That's what's happening in Hungary. It's what's happening in Poland. We're fortunate, and the world is probably fortunate, that the European Union exists as a means of...
tend to forget why it exists, and that was, of
they
course,
do.
To prevent war in Europe.
Precisely. That's why it was created. And I do not understand why Australian Conservatives hate it so much. I mean, I know that some Australian Conservatives, particularly people like Tony Abbott and John Howard, are sort of little are Anglophiles who agree with the sort of the rustic view or the nostalgic view of Little Britain and, you know, the great little fighting nation and so on, which is really what is behind Brexit. But the European Union was created as a means of unifying the countries of Europe into one economic organisation where everybody shared an economic destiny, and therefore, you know, the nationalistic pressures that caused or led to the previous world wars were suppressed. I think it's still doing that. I mean, obviously, it's still doing that. It's still relatively effective. But as we can see from, you know, what's happening now in Nagorno-Karabakh, where ethnic, you know, hatreds run in so deep that people are still prepared to kill each other. If you go
to heavens above, the United States of America is another example.
Well, yes, exactly. And, those forces. The worry is, and this is, you know, what we see with Trump and others, that there are political... nationalism's a very easy thing to manipulate, a very easy thing to stir, a very difficult thing to control once it's been stirred. And, we see that happening in a lot of places, and that worries me, definitely worries me a lot.
I think you chose your time very well, Jeff, you know, the golden age of journalism. And so much of your experiences is in the book, which finishes, incidentally, beloved listener, with a quote from Malcolm McCarris, who said that Australian political history showed that a party always lost the election after the one it should have lost. I find that very beguiling.
Well, I mean, we've got a long way to go. I think Australian politics is extraordinary at the moment. We shouldn't draw conclusions now about what's going to happen at the election in 12 months' time. So much can happen, so much can change. But that's probably the Labor Party's hope, I guess.
But you made the point earlier that it's going to be damned hard for a Labor Party to win against this deafening wall of anti-Labor propaganda.
Yeah. I think fundamentally it'll depend on what happens to the economy. It usually does. Obviously, Albanese's got a lot to prove, a long way to go, but I think he's operating in incredibly difficult circumstances at the moment. The sort of sense that the need to fight COVID as in a sort of as a national effort makes it hard for an opposition leader. But anything can happen. I mean, look at the evidence before ICAC this week. And suddenly, events change very, very dramatically.
Isn't it odd, Jeff? There you are, starting in that little paper, the Manjimup Times, and your career takes off from that. And, of course, these local papers are now, they've gone.
Very sadly. There is still a Manjimup paper, I gather, but, the loss of regional and local newspapers is one of the tragedies of the dramatic changes that have occurred in the media in recent years. Those little papers, I mean, I learnt so much working on that paper about people and about communities and about politics. Everything in the end comes down to politics, including in little communities like that. And those papers really were part of the democratic process, and the loss of them, I think, is a tragedy, and there's a cost to that. When you see efforts to get some of these little papers going again, they need to be supported, they need to be applauded, because they play a big role. By the way, I don't think anybody could follow my career path now. I don't think it'd be possible to start.
You'd need a university education these days.
Yeah, exactly.
And the old, the idea of becoming a copy boy, that's sort of gone.
Yeah, well, there's no such thing as a copy boy. There's not even such thing as a sub-editor these days, as far as I know. That shows, I must say, it's up in the media. But, those paths have gone. I don't think many news organisations are actually even taking on trainees anymore. And I think the other thing that's, a big problem and a big loss is the loss of some of the best people in journalism from journalism as a result of redundancies, particularly at Fairfax and at the ABC.
And on that unhappy note, we take our leave of you, Geoffrey. Jeff Kidney's new book, Beyond the Newsroom, published by Wilkinson Publishing. And, that's our lot. But tomorrow's program, very important, because Yiannis Varoufakis rejoins us. Would you believe that Yiannis has turned to science fiction to predict the future of politics? And conservative US punter David Frum is also on the program, and he'll be bringing us up to date with the latest in the horror story that is US politics. And Andrew Lee comes on the program to talk about reconnecting our communities. Bye for now.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.